You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. It is Thursday. Joining me from east to west is Will Costantini. William, how are you?
Great day out here in the Midwest, early fall.
Yeah, you know what? The weather only gets better for a while, and then it gets worse. So
yeah, winter is coming.
So good luck with that deal. And then from McAllen, Texas, Tim Lynch. Tim, how are you?
Everything's just fine here in McAllen, high in the upper 80s, low humidity. It's beautiful.
Yeah. McAllen be nice for the rest of the year, right, till next spring?
Oh, no, we'll get another hot spell. No, you'll get back up to 90, 100 sometime in the end of the month, but we get one more, and then it'll be nice.
Got it. And then from Southern California, the San Clemente area, is Jeff Kenny. Jeff, how are you?
Oh, hold on. Camp Pendleton right now.
Oh, go ahead.
Good, Matt.
Jeff's working like he always is.
Yeah, but this is the last thing I'm doing today before I'm going to swing up by the infantry immersion trainer for one last time, and then I'm going home. So,
all right, I'm a bit disturbed by a recurring theme in the nation. I want to talk about. What I really talk about is. We'll get your thoughts on where does this thing go into the future? Because I'm pretty pessimistic. And I'll give you the three latest renditions of it. First of all, we have the ongoing theme in the nation that, you know, that cops in this country are hunting black men in spite of, you know, whatever database you look in, Washington Post, FBI, whatever you look at. That's not, in fact, the case. Okay, so in spite of that, the national narrative is that cops are hunting, you know, black men, and so you have the reporting get slanted that way. You have social media amplifying that reporting, and so the truth comes out, and it's a shock. And then, so anyway, Louisville going through that. The COVID thing is another example. The United States is the largest country with the lowest mortality rate, under 3% in the world. Everybody north of us, Germany had been extolled. And again, Mac, where are you getting these statistics? From the Johns Hopkins database. Okay. COVID mortality by nation. Go look at that. The United States, 2.9. Everybody else, every other major developed country is north of us. Yet the narrative in the United States is you would never know that. If you said that as somebody's railing on, you know, COVID and whatnot, and if you said, yeah, but do you know that ours is the lowest mortality rate in the world for developed nations? The answer to that would be no. And so then the third one on top of that is now the Supreme Court thing. If you watch the news, you know, you would think, oh my God, like how could the president nominate somebody and fill the seat so close to the election? And then you do something stupid, like you take a look at American history and you try to get smart before you open your pie hole. And then you find out that this has happened in the nation's history, you know, 19 times. And every time that it's happened, the president has put forward a nominee for the Supreme Court. And when the party that owns the White House owns the Senate, that nomination is advanced. And it hasn't been since 1888 that there has been a nomination that's been made to the Supreme Court by the president of one party with the Senate in the other party that somebody got advanced. Okay, so that's a lot, but nowhere in this discussion do those things seem to matter. So, you know, the truth and our history doesn't matter. It's just this bloviating shit that comes through your television. And so where does this take the nation? And then when you layer on top of that, weak leaders, and we've seen them, the mayor of Minneapolis, the mayor of Seattle, the mayor of Portland, and the mayor of Los Angeles. Everybody wants to be a nice guy and not live up to their oath to support and defend not only the Constitution, but the laws in the city and the people of the city that they are, that they've sworn that oath to. So so I'm curious about, and I'm pessimistic. I think that this gets worse. I think this gets worse as we have to re-educate all the population on the importance of the First Amendment, the importance of the right to peacefully assemble, but not burn cities down. And you're not allowed to do that. The importance of, you know, critical thinking and public discourse be done respectfully, right, and include everybody, which is not always easy, but the importance of that and not having this constantly skewed discourse in the country. So, Will, we'll start with you. Where do you think this takes the nation? Where does this take us?
Yeah, I'm reminded of a O'Toole's corollary. O'Toole's corollary to Murphy's Law. Remember, Murphy said, "What can go wrong will go wrong," and O'Toole said Murphy was an optimist. So I think you're Murphy right now. You're an optimist if you're only pessimistic. I think it's really bad. And at some point, are we going to look over the precipice and draw back from it? I don't know. We may go right over the cliff, because fundamentally it's about the education of the population. The idea that people don't know enough history and really don't have the critical thinking skills to work their way through it and see the wackos on the extreme of any issue for what they are as wackos, and then come up with what they think based on a little bit of research. And you and I have talked about this before. You only got to get to the second or third question before you really start. You get rid of the crap on top and get to the truth. But you're talking about a fundamental reordering of how people are taught, what they're taught about, what they think about, and how they absorb information. You know, right now people's attention span is—it's not even 240 characters, right? I'm not on Twitter, but the stuff I see is like 30 characters long, and those are long ones. So for people to have the ability to actually read a book and think about how whatever somebody says today may have fit with what they've learned through a lifetime accumulation of knowledge is really challenging. And I'm not optimistic in the slightest. And, you know, you combine that with record gun sales in the last 7 months and you can't buy ammunition off the shelf, and it just doesn't bode well.
Tim, how about you?
Well, you know, the problem is, as Will just said, is culture is upstream of everything. It's upstream of politics. It's upstream of the entertainment industry. And the culture right now doesn't bode well because we've had so many years of progressive educational ideology infiltrate not only in the schools, but throughout the government. And I've my most optimistic hope, and I'm still kind of leaning when it's going to go this way, is that Trump's going to win in a landslide. There's this thing down here called the Trump train. Keep in mind, I'm in the Democratic dominated part of the state, 94% Hispanic down here, right? And on every Saturday morning, started at 8 o'clock, it started out with a couple hundred. Now there's 1,000 friggin' trucks flying Trump and American flags, driving up and down 10th Street, honking their horns. You're not going to see any kind of popular support for Biden. It's a replay of what happened with Clinton. When my truck drivers would tell me all around the country, all they saw were Trump signs. That's all I see too. But even if he wins in a landslide, you know, because he's making moves to take back the culture. That what the Secretary of Education just did by issuing that letter to Princeton saying, "Oh, you're racist. Well, you signed documents that said you're not a racist institution and got federal money, so we want that money back." I think that's brilliant. The idea of starting a 1776 project to counter the 1619 project is brilliant. All these things are brilliant. yet you're talking about an institution. I mean, after Trump put out that executive order on the 2nd of September saying that we're going to take away all of this critical race theory indoctrination from the federal government, not 5 days later, the head of the Naval Academy put out a paper where he starts with, hey, team, or no, it starts out team, where basically in the paper he says we're going to do all of the following things. That they are going to be they're going to be trained in critical race theory. They've got all these diversity, inclusion, and equity teams throughout the university led by the Marine Corps. Only two people are referred to by name in the order, and that is George Floyd, you know, a career criminal who died of an overdose, and Captain Tamika Lindsay, who the insiders say is heading to be the superintendent of the academy and rapidly become an admiral. They're the only two people mentioned in this entire order that directly contradicts what the president just said. So,
okay, hold on.
We've got problems.
Where is this going?
Well, I was hoping it was going to go to a reelection of Trump and a reaffirmation amongst the American people, because a vast majority of us believe this is a great country founded on solid principles, and we want those principles taught to our children. And the only hope we have is that the children being taught now are like children from every generation, and they revolt against whatever the hell their elders are telling them is being uncool, and they start wearing American flags to piss off their teachers. It's about the only hope we have right now. So I hope it's going towards a landslide and a redirection of the common culture towards valuing America and American exceptionalism. But I think it's too far to go. Not when you've got a Naval Academy, a military reacting as it is to his executive orders on purpose, flouting them in the face of the president. That right there means that he wins in a landslide, and we're still going to get 4 more years of bogus investigations, divisiveness, and constant attacks that all of them prove out to be fraudulent, but nobody's ever punished.
I'm not really talking about Trump, and I'm talking about as a nation.
Well, as a nation, we're going to be torn up by that. Where can we go? We can go nowhere with it down, my friend. We can't. We're not even dealing with factual information. If you would just humor me for a second, because the CDC just tabulated out the IFR, the infection fatality ratio for COVID, and for in our age group 50 to 69, it's 0.0005. That is much less than the flu, and we're still in lockdown over this shit.
Okay, hold on. Where is this going, though? All these other rabbit holes aside, where are we going as a people? That's the question.
We're on a downward slope of history, buddy. We're going right into the shitter of divisiveness and paying attention to things that aren't even important and not addressing things that are. That's what's going to happen. Even if Trump wins another term, it's the uphill swim against the culture is too vast. Dude, things are not looking good for us. That's all I can say. I don't think it's going to be armed revolt or anything like that. But I don't see how we can coexist with the Democrat craziness as it's manifesting itself right now. I don't see how you do it.
Jeff, how about you? Where do you see the nation going?
I think we're going into an era of terrorist attacks, and I'll tell you why.
You mean domestic terror?
Yes. Yeah. Terrorist attacks. And the reason I do that is I look at the history of this thing, and it's pretty connected. I mean, people are still alive who are alive doing this stuff in the late 60s and early 70s and all the way through the 70s into the early 80s. And, originally started out as kind of a mixture of the anti, you know, the race, race protests and against discrimination, particularly down south, and at the same time the burgeoning resentment over being drafted for the Vietnam War, which reached a fever pitch, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, and these people who are trained radicals. You know, in the campuses, the Students for a Democratic Society, which became the Weathermen, which branched off into other groups. This branching off happened when the one unifying factor of the whole thing went away. In January of 1973, the draft ended. immediately the bottom fell out of all these protests. They just didn't happen anymore. People weren't, thousands and thousands of kids weren't queuing up to, you know, to burn down the ROTC building. What was the point? The threat was gone. And it just stopped. And so what these folks did is they thought that the you know, all the unrest and the burning, like Kent State, all that stuff, would go on and on until they had victory. So they're bitterly disappointed. And they turned to terror, murder. You had the Symbionese Liberation Army. It's the same folks. You had the Black Liberation Army. Again, the same folks. You had, you know, the Weather Underground setting off bombs. And most of these people, if they didn't blow themselves up because they're generally incompetent, got caught and sent to prison. And they went to country club prisons. And at the first chance of being paroled, they were. They were treated with kid gloves. And I'm talking of people like Bernadette Dorn and several of these people. They get treated. They're immediately paroled, and they immediately get jobs where? In the university. So you got Angela Davis, who's a professor. She has no qualifications, not really, except, you know, participated in murder plots and stuff. And the same thing with all these people. And they turned to terror. And when they went to jail, they weren't really punished. They were coddled. They're coddled both by the educated class, and I say pseudo-educated class in the United States, people who went to college during that time. And I agree with Tim to the extent that it's worse now because the indoctrination of that type of philosophy is taking place a hell of a lot earlier. And President Trump is the first one with the guts to actually go against that and say this is a no-no. But, you know, to your point, Mac, to your question, where's this going to go? We're going to have this stuff because I agree with Tim that Trump is going to be victorious. But even if he's not, the impetus for this stuff is going to go away after the election. And even though the election will be a contentious thing, you know, because of factors, and I don't want to get into right now, I don't want to waste your time, but, you know, that's what I believe. I believe these people are going to be devastated by the fact that once the election happens, a lot of people are going to say, okay, we got 4 years, I can't keep this up. I can't keep burning down Portland every night. I can't keep, burning down Seattle and, you know, in half a dozen or dozen other cities across the United States. They're going to run out of steam. They're going to have to take a breath. And when they do that, it's going to piss these people off. You know, they're enraged now. And so I think they're going to turn to that. They'll be crushed, you know, but the problem is our news media, just like the rather apathetic news media we had back during the 70s and stuff, they're even worse now. They're actually no shit on the side in a lot of cases of these people who are using violence and anti-democratic, certainly anti-constitutional methods to get their way. And I think that's where we're going.
All right, let me ask you a second question. How bad do you think it's going to get? Do you think we're going to see violence in the street? You know, Will mentioned gun sales and things like that. Do you think ultimately, I'll start with you, Will. Do you think it will be? And then again, we're going to relearn lessons of law and order. We're going to relearn lessons like of peaceful assembly and importance of the First Amendment and respecting the First Amendment as opposed to, I don't like them, so I think I could shut their voice down and I can do that if I want to. Which is what you hear from a lot of places around the country. So, Will, how bad do you think it's going to get?
Well, I think, you know, if the election is in great doubt, which it is likely to be for a couple of weeks, you put that together with whoever loses is going to feel robbed. And the actual and then the psychological restrictions on that are out there, and so you've got an angry group of people that are likely armed, and I think that the thing you saw in Kenosha where that kid ended up shooting a couple of people, I think that is small potatoes compared to potentially what can happen out there, and I don't know that it'll be coordinated, but I think you're going to see it in a lot more places. You know, where I live in Johnson County is nominally Democrat controlled area of the state. And a lot of Kansas conservatives are sort of milquetoast, but they tend to dominate just because the rural area. But in this part of the county, it's Democrat. And so the yard signs you see out there, you see two kinds of signs. You see Democrat campaign signs and you see American flags. And you never see both of those on the same house. And so some battle lines are drawn. And I know just talking to people around here, it's amazing the sort of vitriol people will spit out about their neighbors because of a campaign sign. And these are, you know, retiree sort of people who don't get excited about that much stuff, except if it's Wheel of Fortune's on twice tonight, you know, they get excited. So if those kinds of people are getting fired up, I can only imagine what people who are a little more volatile in more volatile parts of the country and what they're going to be willing to do to what they think is protect themselves or to take matters to their own hands. And yeah, it sounds crazy. There's somewhere on the order of 300 or 400 million firearms in the hands of private citizens right now. I think that there's going to be not necessarily coordinated, but I think that there's going to be violence in November.
Yeah.
All right. Tim, how about you?
Oh, I agree. I think there's violence right now. There's shooting in the streets in Minneapolis right now. And I think that will certainly, assuming a Trump win, get worse. And like I said, I'm hoping for a decisive one because if it's close, that's going to be a national nightmare. I'm not worried about violence breaking out down here. Like I said, this is 94% Hispanic. Although there's a huge Trump supporters down here, they're not going to go fighting each other over him. And black lives are irrelevant down here. There's none of them here. So it's not going to happen here. I don't think it's going to get as bad where you are, Mac, because I don't think as they try to spill this out into the white suburbs, as I've been seeing that they've been attempting to do in Minneapolis and whatnot, I don't think that's going to go too well, quite frankly. And I suspect, as Will has been pointing out, that when the pushback comes, it's going to come from the people being victimized in the form of semi-automatic rifle fire. And they could stack up quite a few people very quickly at the ranges that these confrontations are happening. But let me ask you, what would you do if you're sitting in a restaurant with a date and this and people just barge in by the dozens and start demanding that you kneel and say Black Lives Matter and stuff like that? I mean, that's a rather intolerable assault on an individual's liberty for Americans to tolerate. And I'm waiting for one of those confrontations to go south.
All right, Jeff. How about you? What do you think? What I'm really interested in is, I got one more question for everybody on this. But go ahead, Jeff. Where does this go in terms of the confrontation?
I have a definite idea about this. And if I was them, and I mean, if I was the type of person who didn't want President Trump to be reelected, and I wanted to affect the election, and I had no scruples, what I would do is I would make noise, which I know would be echoed by the mainstream media, by almost all media, that anybody who votes in person is really looking to be to continue the racist white superiority mantra that they've been doing. Anyone who does that, and so they can pretty much say that anybody who shows up in person to vote at a polling place, particularly in population areas that are usually red, they will try and intimidate. There will be violence at that polling site, at those polling sites, and they will try and affect the vote that way. They'll try and keep people up, because I'm supposed to be at 29 Palms that week. I'm coming home to vote, because I think, like Tim, that it's going to be a substantial victory from on the Republican side, presidential anyway, and I think if they push this thing with the Supreme Court, it'll even result in more rupturing of the uncertain voters right now towards the Republican side. But I believe that they will try to influence the day of the election that way so that it will appear in as many red places like there's chaos there. And the chaos will be real, but it won't be spontaneous. It'll be no shit planned. But if we don't start seeing really full court press towards saying anyone who votes in person is the enemy, and anyone who votes by mail is good to go, then it won't be that effective. We should start seeing that really get stressed pretty heavy soon.
All right, Tim, you were going to say something. Hey,
Matt, yeah, man. In 2009, I watched Lieutenant Colonel Jeff Kenney risk his fucking ball. I mean, take massive risk with him and his Marines to ensure people would come to the polling station and vote. And how fucked up is it that 10 years later, he's in America and he's talking about having to battle through the same type of friggin' friction in order to get a vote? That's weird, dude. That's just so typical of this year. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
I mean, he lost people trying to secure Afghans the right to fucking vote. And now we're sitting here talking about voting in person here as being a revolutionary act. Good God, that's just disheartening.
Yeah. One more question. I don't want to hear the word Trump in all of this. What I want you all to address is, where does this go as a nation in terms of this concoction of the media, social media, critical thinking, and the truth? It's like we don't in our public discourse we don't entertain the truth anymore. We don't start. How does that get reversed? Where do you go with that? How does that get reversed? It's like the educational system in this country has been taken over, and when you do talk about factual things with young people, they look at you like you're crazy. And you say, well, you could look that up, and you could look that up, and you could look that up. And then after you do that, if you want to have another conversation, we could do that. But how does that get changed? Because, you know, the discourse in this country is awful. It doesn't exist. You know, and again, if you go to the Supreme Court thing, you have people ready to go to Washington, D.C., get on the first plane. This is not going to happen. You know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, blah, 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 blah. Well, wait a minute. I mean, if you read the nation's history and you see how whatever party in charge does it, if they own the White House, you know, but none of that is included in our public discourse. Will, any thoughts on how that changes?
I don't know how the hyper partisanship can change in the short term, because the politics of the nation are decided on the edges, not in the middle. And maybe, you know, people in Washington, D.C. actually talk to each other. We never see it, but they can't admit it in public. And so how does that change is really the $64,000 question. It just in terms of this Supreme Court thing. The whole argument is absolutely ridiculous to start out with. But can you imagine if the Republican majority was in doubt, and that's a significant group, you know, another gang of whatever, went out and tried to sort of reach across the aisle to come to the more thoughtful discourse? I think your average milquetoast Republican would go ballistic based on how Supreme Court nominees have been treated, in the last 30 years or so since Bork.
Right.
So how do you, at the highest levels, get that sort of discussion going? I I don't know, because I wouldn't trust anyone that, that would start it. Again, we may have to get right up to the edge of that abyss before anything happens. I don't know how many times we've been close to it in the country. You know, we know what happened in 1860. We got up, looked over the abyss, and then we jumped. Right. And I'm not saying there's going to be a civil war, but something that really can destroy the fabric of the country, you know? I don't know, right? I'm intrigued by anybody who's got a reasonably thoughtful way to do it, because I sure don't right now.
Got it. You know, just, I mean, so you go back, you mentioned Justice Bork, right? So, I mean, the liberal justices, Sonia Sotomayor, who was a lefty, she was confirmed 68-31 with 9 Republican votes. Justice Ginsburg confirmed 96-3. Justice Breyer, 87-9. Elena Kagan, 63-37. And so it's interesting that the, you know, it's only the conservatives that, you know, that get this applied to them, because the conservatives don't tend to apply this to liberals. They say, oh, no, it's, you know, they're qualified. I don't agree with their point of view, but it's certainly a good nomination and eminently qualified, and that's what I'm supposed to do. I'm not supposed to vote up or down on the merits of their political views, but are they qualified to sit on the court? And so to me, and now that narrative, right, of being quote unquote borked, that narrative is now applied to so much of the discussion that we can't even have a discussion anymore, for God's sakes, you know. And that's so Timmy, your thoughts on that?
Well, the good news is a lot of the of our cultural culturally dominant organizations are right now in disarray. I mean, in nautical terms that we've been reading all summer, they've taken a long lance torpedo below the waterline, and they're hemorrhaging water and they're limping along. Whether we're talking Hollywood, whether we're talking professional sports, who I've now lumped with Hollywood, whether we're talking the news, the news industries. Back when we were kids and there was only 3 stations, they were competing for eyeballs, and they had to appeal to the vast majority of the audience in order to get the vast majority of the audience. They were in competition, and they certainly weren't out there to push anybody's agenda like we see now. The only hope is that with these the edifice of with these powerful institutions, these powerful social institutions, with them under attack and hemorrhaging water, is that people wake up, because now, because of COVID, people are rethinking education, but people are rethinking about investing in office buildings. They're rethinking about a lot of things. And one of the things that they're definitely rethinking is how much our university education is worth, given the activities that go on in today's universities. And so the only hope is that the common culture amongst we, the people, all Americans, that they generally start thinking along the same lines that we think. And I think a vast majority do. I think that's why we get why you get people listening to us go on and on about this stuff. We're talking from the cultural perspective of somebody who's very proud to be Americans, and with warts and all, you know. And we're not like we're like the victims of foreign policy of America, as Jeff had said, bitter ones at that at times. But we love the damn country. And I think until you see, because it's not going to come from the top down, not when Trump's not from the top down, no matter who wins. It's got to be something that a vast majority of people start moving towards, because the systems that are serving them right now are broken. And the one thing that we should take away from this COVID-19 response is that when the elites start preaching to us with predictive models of complex systems, we should laugh in their face, because they've never had a model that can predict any type of complex system at all. Yet that's what they use to regulate us. And it's a fantasy. And I think that ultimately people are going to realize this when they understand what a 0.005 IFR means. It means we've been taken to the cleaners for nothing.
Jeff.
Oh, geez. You know, I really got into listening to what Timmy was saying, I think that you know, the future for us is, as far as you know, what we should do is, I think follow the president's lead on this. You know that the your education is really your own responsibility, and it's not easy anymore. But you can find the truth. You know, I mean, I have to tell you guys, I looked for the Breonna Taylor thing today, for the last couple of days on on Google, and you don't get in there that the boyfriend started shooting at the police first. You don't get it. You get this like nebulous descriptionist thing. And it makes you think they just walked up to a house and started blowing rounds through the window. And so you just, it's, even though information is accessible, if it's perceived as the air quotes wrong information, you won't get the right stuff. So you gotta research on your own. And there's people out there that you can trust. That will send you the right way. I think the Prager University, things like that. Your public library, not to my knowledge, they haven't started going in there and taking out, Funkin' Wagnalls and the encyclopedias and throwing them out. So you can find out the accurate side of what happened. And then if you stress the idea that you're hearing a version when you hear one person talk, there's other people talking about that same subject who may have their own version. You owe it to yourself to get all sides. And I think what's coming clear now is the brick and mortar universities are losing their appeal. They're expensive. I mean, look at with with COVID. I mean, they're seeing these kids on Zoom and the kid like has a gun or something that in the background, or, there's somebody in there and they're not wearing masks. So they suspend the kid or disenroll him, but they don't give him back his tuition. I mean, that should be illegal, and it's the universities have a lot of chutzpah, and for no good reason, because unless you're talking hard sciences that result in like a medical degree, their brand sucks. We're heading down the ladder as it comes to, educational effectiveness in the world. We're heading down, not up. So I think that's the key, self-education and pushing that,
Yeah, to me, the whole thinking skills and just, respectful discourse and listening are lost arts in our country. And then when you layer on top of that social media and you just look and you're like, how does this turn around? How does this get better without something really, really awful going on in the country? And so I'm not much of a pessimist on it. I just don't see. And again, when you see the major leaders in the country, and you see what's gone on in Portland and Seattle, and you see the fact that they don't stand up and say, "Hey, look, I don't care what you think. You don't have the right to do this." And when you don't see universal condemnation of stuff like that, like, I get you're pissed, but this needs to stop. When you don't see that, and they're doing that for political gain, it's like, man, how broke are we as a nation? And if you go down that road, then it's gonna take something really bad. And that something really bad is one day closer, I can tell you that. And again, I go back and I think of that guy who went to that softball or baseball practice in Alexandria. But for the fact that he went in the third base gate, tried to get in the third base gate that was locked and was seen, he would have killed, 30 or 40 congressmen.
Right.
Right. He had them penned in a cage with a couple of weapons. And so, but that didn't slow them down. I mean, they digested that and went on about their, in my opinion, their business, and that is the business of promoting themselves and getting themselves reelected and playing the American game of politics. But I'm probably more pessimistic than I've ever been about the future of the country, and I just don't see in all these issues that we talk about. You look for the truth, and it's not being discussed. And you're just like, holy shit, man. Where does it take us when we can't have a discussion about the truth? So anyway. All right. Second subject is Gulf States and Middle East peace. In our lifetime, I never thought I would see, what we saw, and that is this migration. Last week, this migration of Gulf states recognizing Israel. Jeff, your thoughts on what happened?
Yeah, I think that's a masterstroke. And what it is, it's because President Trump is a neophyte when it comes to foreign affairs, and because he looks at everything, you know, through untainted glasses. He's like, well, okay, if we can't, why does it have to be that the first thing that has to happen is peace between Israel and Palestine? You know, he's like, if that's a surface, let's go for some gaps. And so he goes with people who have issues and want relief from those issues. And they're not really as hot about hating the Israelis as the people who live on their borders, or at least the Palestinians who live on those borders. I mean, it was achieved with Egypt. He's probably thinking, well, heck, if we did it with the Egyptians, you know, why can't we do it with, these Gulf state guys, and by extension, you know, sooner or later, Saudi Arabia. And eventually, you know, there's a skillful blend of amateur foreign policy, and I don't mean the amateur in a pejorative way. I mean amateur in that you're not subject to any preconceived, universal truths. And that's, again, in air quotes. It's not a universal truth that the Pakistan-Israeli thing has to be solved first. Not at all. And so this puts pressure. The truth is that Iran is the main backer of the militant groups in Palestine. And the truth is that Iran is the main threat to those Gulf states. It's perfectly logical to go this way. But it's inspired because it seems obvious now, but it didn't seem that way until they did it. So I got to give him kudos for that. I'm sure it's not – this guy Pompeo is a smart cookie, and I hate to say it, but I hate nepotism, you know. It's never worked for me. But, I like the idea of the president's son-in-law apparently has his shit together. You know, he's a mover in this stuff. So my attitude to the thing is that's a hopeful thing. I mean, and again, it's because of I don't have any, I believe in the law of gravity. I believe in that if you're underwater, you can't breathe. But that's about it when it comes to, there's no physical science involved in human relations.
All right. Will, how about you?
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing. And a couple of precursors to it, the U.S. being self-sufficient in energy really liberates us to think a little bit differently. And the people that were putting the shackles on that was really the previous administration. So opening that up gave us an opportunity. And then the second thing is, as Jeff said, you know, we weren't beholden to the universal truth that existed within the Beltway. The president said this is a problem, and he just didn't want to admire it. So he said, how do we solve it? And I would say sort of the next extension, I don't doubt that you'll see more governments come on. I don't know if Oman has come on yet. Saudi Arabia may or may not come on until the current king fades away. And that's really the big one. Saudis are the 800-pound gorilla. And then the next thing that I would just be a little bit careful of is that while the leadership in those countries has come on because they can calculate what's in their best interest, their populations, who really don't have a say in their governments, but their populations have been propagandized for the last 80 years to hate Israel. And so there could be some unrest. You could see assassination type stuff. You know, that's what happened to Sadat when he made peace with Israel. That could potentially, and that'll be spurred by the Iranians without a doubt. But it is pretty historic. And just like those manufacturing jobs are not coming back, just like the U.S. is never going to be sufficient in energy, so we've got to cut everything back. Just like there's never going to be peace in the Middle East, it is sort of interesting what's been accomplished by a guy who doesn't know shit about how Washington, D.C. works.
Yeah. Timmy?
To illustrate how significant it is, you know, with UAE and Israel having full relationships and whatnot, UAE, Dubai specifically, invested a huge amount of money to diversify its economy in the tech, and it didn't get far enough along before the 2008 oil bust, and they're hurting. And they're going to suck Israel dry of tech talent, agricultural specialists, and security guys, because the Emiratis that own the UAE, they don't like they're not like policemen and shit. There's not that many of them. Their biggest problem is diabetes. The police force are run by Egyptians and Yemenis and other Arabs and whatnot. And I know that UAE is going to bring in Israelis to help that flesh that out, because inside Dubai, it's spy central for the world. The Russians are there in big numbers. The Iranians are there in big numbers. It's spook central. It's going to be even more spook central-ish now, and it's going to be an awesome place to be. And I never thought in a million years that would happen. But the Emiratis need Israel. They've got technology and making water in agriculture as well as technology that those guys desperately need to keep on growing. And they've got no issues with Israelis or anybody else in Dubai. They don't give a rat's ass about anything, anybody. They're not too happy with Chinese folk, but that's about it.
So what's the driving force for the UAE to do this?
Oh, they've got to. They can read the writing on the wall. Even if the oil comes back, the shale revolution in America has made their market share kind of not worth what it once was, and they've built this entire infrastructure with a big duty free zone and whatnot to be the bridge between Central Asia, Africa, you know, to be the pivot point, and they want to become the Singapore of the Middle East, and they can't do that without Israeli help. I mean, with the Israelis, it's going to be so much simpler, because with the Israelis coming in, it's like hiring Mormons to do your security in the at the casinos. They're honest, you know. They have a reliability issue with them. So I think it's going to be very, very healthy for the Arab countries to have that influx of technology. And Israel's going to do just fine. Israel does just fine on its own. It's a remarkable country. It's a great place to visit, too.
Yeah.
Well, I want to go back to you. What's the driving force for Israel? I mean, for the UAE?
Well, the number one driving force for UAE is Iranian nuclear weapons and Iranian – basically, you know, the Shia side of the Muslim schism radicalizing on the other side of the pond there. So they need more friends, more reliable friends, and they don't have even remotely close to a population that can defend itself. Again, the leadership is able to calculate and say that sort of riding this anti-Israeli propaganda helped us in a lot of ways distract the population from potentially not achieving things that they wanted to achieve. That has played out over 70 years, and it's probably pretty dead. And particularly now, I don't know how restricted the internet is in a lot of those countries, but I'm pretty sure that people there can see what the rest of the world looks like, and they want a piece of that. So you put a big, scary, and very close neighbor and a desire to continue into the future, and I think it makes it fairly easy for the leadership to be able to shift. And that, they've got some work to do with their population to make sure that it doesn't retrench or that craziness doesn't happen. But that's why I think you're going to see more of it. And I think you definitely see it in Saudi Arabia if it weren't for there's still some real old people on the top of that thing. But they ain't going to be there long. And I think that next generation is more than lukewarm to having this happen between Saudi Arabia and Israel.
Oh, wow. I mean, that's interesting. You know, the United States kind of unassing the region, right? A bit of a vacuum relative to that, combined with, you know, the heightened Iranian ambitions, and you could see the impetus to drive, you know, why not make a deal? What's in our interest to keep us from, you know, this recognition of Israel and maybe someday a security pact with Israel in conjunction with the United States fortifies our weak hand that we have. Jeff, any other thoughts on why the UAE, their motivation for doing it?
Yeah, I agree with Will. I think that Iran is the big one. Iran's a big bully in the neighborhood.
Right.
And they're all over Iraq right now, and they're probably pushing through, you know, influence-wise through Syria. And, of course, they are Hezbollah. You know, they are running the Shia parts of Lebanon, and they're Israel paying the neck for the Israelis. They're paying the neck for everybody. You know, they're down there in Yemen and so forth. So they appear to be acquisitive, and just like Will was saying, the Emiratis, they're not a very big population. And what Tim was saying, they have a lot of, you know, a lot of foreign help. To not only they have a huge American civilian contractor and military advisor presence there. So you know, it seems logical to me that any country who is noticing that the United States is not so dependent, I mean, that's a huge thing, getting off Middle Eastern, you know, petrol, that, you know, they're like saying, hey, we got to give them something. And it's got to be, they're just recognizing the reality of the thing. If we want to help America, right now, America is like disposed to block Iran from their nefarious ambitions. So let's get with them. And, you know, Israel doesn't seem to be, you know, pushing out to conquer, you know, to conquer any more territory. Yet Iran may be, and particularly in the actual Persian Gulf itself. So constant harassment and the sea lanes that they do, you know, they're wanting to get some insurance against that.
The last thing we'll talk about here real quick is the Secretary of the Navy, Secretary Brathwaite, sent out a 100-day message that Will shared with all of us earlier. And, Will, let me start with you. What'd you think of the Secretary's message after 100 days?
Yeah, so, I mean, you and I talked about this when he was at his confirmation. And he right. came out, you know, we need to change the culture, leadership, et cetera. Etc. And in 100 days, he's discovered that everything's great. You're all great. I'm great. Everyone's great. And he talks about visiting the fleet and how enjoyable it was to talk to everyone there. And he highlighted a couple of questions that he got from sailors out in the fleet. And they were asking about stuff, tuition assistance and yada, yada, yada. And so if the secretary was actually serious about doing anything with the culture of the Navy, you would think in his first 100 days he'd talk about leadership, readiness, war fighting, sacrifice for the nation, challenges like the Eisenhower being on a seemingly 10-year odyssey, and they're going to go right back out. And then he doesn't do any of that. And so if you thought that this secretary was going to make a fundamental change in the U.S. Navy, you are out of your mind. Was that pessimistic enough?
It was oddly optimistic, to be honest with you. You're capable of so much more. Tim, your thoughts on Secretary Brathwaite's letter?
Well, you know, after spending a good bit of the summer reading about the fighting admirals of World War II, when I read the secretary's message, it sounded to me like the welcome aboard from the activities coordinator of a cruise line. I mean, it basically was written at that level, and it addressed all kinds of stuff that I can't believe the Secretary of the Navy concerns himself with, and it's yet another indication that there's a significant a percentage of our civilian leadership who honestly believe that we're never going to have to go in and knock it out, drag out, and fight again. They fundamentally believe that there are all kinds of time for us to do all kinds of things and be good people and great social citizens of the world. And I don't believe that we have that type of time or that kind of luxury. And I am alarmed when I read stuff like this. It makes me cranky and irritable.
Jeff, your thoughts after reading it?
Yeah, it's like, of all the secretaries of Navy we ever had, you're one of them. Yeah, it's like it's like Ozzy from Ozzy and Harriet became Secretary of the Navy, or Dick Clark or somebody like that, or the guy who does Jeopardy who's got cancer now. You know, it's like it's just, and then when you juxtapose that against what Timmy was saying about the Naval Academy thing, where it's almost like they're in some kind of insurrection, and then here's this guy saying, I really enjoyed talking to you guys about the twist and assistance we got you, even though it ran out because so many of you tried to get it. We'll make sure we got more next year. Gee, thanks, sir. Yeah, so it's like it's kind of weird. You know, just the whole thing is kind of strange, how the military's dealing with the strange times that we're in. In this particular case, obviously, the Navy.
Well, when I read it, so Will sends it. He goes, we could talk about this. And I read them, and I sit back. There's nothing in there.
That's the point, like Will Smith.
Will says, that's the point. And it's, you know, as Will alluded to, you know, this guy's a career PAO. Yeah. All right? That's what he is.
Oh, there you go, yeah.
Career PAO turned politician. And, you know, he's got the Bonhomme Richard sitting in San Diego, right, burned out, and he's got a Navy that it seems like at least every 2 or 3 weeks there's another incredible revelation about how on its ass it is, and a shipbuilding plan that is deemed not credible and not forwarded to Congress by the Secretary of Defense, and this is his 100-day assessment. Like, it could have been like, here's the status of all the benefit questions that you've asked me over this since I've joined. I mean, but not one mention of, you know, we're going to get this thing to be great again. We're going to make the Navy, you know, manna, make the Navy great again or something like that. Yeah.
He's like the guy who's in charge of Chrysler before Iacocca, you know?
Yeah. It is rather disturbing in its lack of saying, look, we've got work to do, right? If you thought it was hard before, it's going to get more difficult in the future. I just want everybody to be ready for that, because the requirements for us are going up, not down, and this is going to get harder, not easier, because the nation is leaning on the United States Navy in the next conflict. There is no way about that. You know, as we pivot to the Pacific, we are the forward deployed. We are what will face the Chinese, and we've got to be up for that. So it's going to, I mean, there's no challenge about winning and greatness. And so
I think President Trump is going to make the MyPillow guy the next Secretary of the Navy.
He ought to. Hey, he wears blue. He wears blue in his commercials. Come on.
But he's on fire, man. So, yeah.
And yeah, that guy does a lot more than pillows. And Will,
oh, he sure does. He's a good dude.
And Will's got to go.
And no, I just say on my LinkedIn, I'm connected with people who are connected to Admiral Stavridis,
yes,
you know, former NATO guy. And so when the Redskins figured out they had to change their name, and Stavridis started this campaign that says we should call them the Washington Fighting Admirals. And I was thinking to myself, find one.
That's good.
So, wait. Jeff was laughing. What were you thinking, Will?
He says we should rename the team the Washington Fighting Admirals. And I was thinking to myself, oh, where would we find one?
Yeah, that's nice. How about the Fighting Bus Boys?
That's wrong.
How about the spare bartenders?
That's wrong. That's
and it kills you because it was – right? I was born in 1963, 18 years after the end of World War II. We're 18 years after 9/11, and we can name heroes. and they were, were heroes in the Navy at that time.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Heroes. And now, where would you find one?
You're struggling. You're looking for one. Here's an email. Book suggestion to the crew. Hello. I enjoy the book suggestions. Here are two of my own. I have a book you might like. It's on pre-World War II Germany from the point of view of Gregor Zimner, the headmaster of the American School in Berlin from 1928 to 1939. His book was used at the Nuremberg trials. The book is Education for Death, The Making of a Nazi.
That's a good idea.
The other book I just finished is Fall and Rise, The Story of 9/11 by Mitchell Zukov. He left me emotionally exhausted. Peace out, Mark. So a couple of book suggestions because people do listen, people do write. So
I think that's the Secretary of Navy, Mark Zucker. But anyway,
the Mitchell Zucker. I'm sorry.
Okay.
What are you reading, Will?
I finished that book I talked about last week, American Moonshot. It's actually a pretty interesting book. It sort of traces how we got to Apollo through the lens mostly of John F. Kennedy. And I got to think I knew a lot of the history, but the book really draws out some very interesting parts of that and how Kennedy sort of evolved over time and how he thought about the Apollo program. And, you know, some interesting numbers. I think in 1962 or 1963, NASA was 5% of the federal budget.
Wow.
So he bet a lot on that. And so we wouldn't have gone to the moon without Kennedy. But I got to tell you, if Kennedy had been assassinated, we may not have gone there either. Because he would have been in a knife fight in his second term. Whereas they were able to use, you know, Kennedy's pledge to steamroll Congress. And what I'm reading now is a biography of Thomas Edison by Edmund Morris. So wrote like a three-volume biography of Theodore Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. And this book is good, but it's also bad. It's good because everyone's heard about Edison. But I got to tell you, I didn't know anything about the guy. He had 1,100 patents to his name. And he started over 100 companies in his lifetime. So really interesting sort of factual stuff. But I think Morris lost his mind when he was trying to write Reagan's biography. You know, he's Reagan's official biographer.
Yeah.
And he spent like 5 years with him and said, gee, I can't think of anything. So he wrote sort of a pseudo-fictional biography. And so this biography of Edison goes in reverse order of his life. So you're going backwards in time as you read it. And it's just a little bit weird. But an unbelievably interesting person, again, that I think everyone's heard of, but I don't think most people know a lot about. So,
would you recommend reading it backwards?
I don't know. I got to wait till I get to the end, which might be the beginning, to figure out if I should have gone forward or backward in time to read the book. So it's confusing in that way.
Oh, that's awesome. Timmy, what do you...
Yes.
Don't forget
Edison
that point.
Edison by Edmund Morris.
Yeah, Morris. If you want to understand every animal that Theodore Roosevelt skinned as a young man, pick up volume one of that trilogy.
Yeah.
And Morris documents it. Every skin he hung on the side of a shed. And what was that bay that they lived? Oyster Bay in Long Island. So, the Roosevelt clan. Timmy, what are you reading?
I'm still with The Conquering Tide by Ian W. Toll. And I'm going through the Guadalcanal campaign. Covering the same territory that Hornfisher did with Neptune's Inferno, although he's not duplicating anything that Hornfisher did. It's really an enjoyable read, and I continue to learn stuff I didn't know. I'm just enjoying the hell out of reading it.
How's the school going?
Oh, school's going great. It's just not that hard. I mean, I got of the three courses, only one of them has a class that meets on Zoom. The other two you do self-directed. And so on Monday morning, they do the lesson for the week, and I'm pretty much done by Tuesday noon. You know, it's not hard. It's kind of easy. And so I've got to work on a term paper, but it leaves me plenty of time to read and goof off. It's not that challenging, to be perfectly honest.
All right. Well, that's good to know. Jeff, how about you? What are you reading?
Well, I'm reading The Sand Pebbles by McKenna, and it's very good. It's like the one thing I forgot about the book is, besides the fact it gives you a real taste for what it was like in between the wars in China, you know, and just in Asia in general, it talks about military fear, it talks about officer to enlisted leadership, particularly when both of them are professional. I mean, they're both the enlisted guys and the officers were lifers, as we used to say in the Marine Corps, and that there wasn't anybody who just came in for, you know, these guys were in it for the long haul. They made a life out of it. And so that was, you know, it's interesting about that. And it's there's a lot of great insights in that book, you know, and it's basically these guys are kind of, they're in the river going down with this, you know, this boat, this gunboat. And it starts out, things are pretty friendly, but there's civil unrest in China in the late 20s between the nationalists and the burgeoning communists, and you know, it's very violent, and they're in the middle of it. And at first they're being used by both sides, and you know, things, obviously it gets kinetic and so forth. So it's a entertaining book, you know. And plus you always harken back to the film. You know, it was a great film too. You know, with you know, Steve McQueen and Richard Crenna, so it's good. And at the same time, I'm still reading the book by Hornfisher, Neptune's Inferno, and also the book by Gilbert about the Holocaust. And so those two, like, you get motivated reading Hornfisher, then you get depressed reading reading Gilbert, and then you get entertained reading Sand Pebbles. So it's like, you know, I go back and forth between them. And I'm asleep after 15 minutes of reading nowadays. The old days of reading for 2.5 hours are done for me.
All right, boys. First of all, thanks for the visit. And just a note to everybody: you're not talking to people that tend to be glass half empty kind of people, other than. Will can be the preacher of doom and gloom, but he's normally rooted in sanity when he does it. But I think it's interesting that, you know, we're all extremely concerned about, you know, I think very, very basic issues in our country, the lack of critical thinking skills, the lack of being able to have a civil discussion with people you don't agree with. And none of that bodes well for the nation. And like a lot of other things now, are we going to have to relearn those lessons? And in order to relearn those, how bad is it going to have to get in this country that most people say, hey, look, everybody's got to respect each other. Everybody's got to pay attention to what the law says. And there's got to realize that there's more than one side to this discussion. And you got to be willing to listen. And I don't see what breaks us from something that stops us from something really bad happening so we can all learn that lesson. And I hope I'm wrong. But I don't think I am. I don't think any of us are. So anyway, boys, thanks for the visit. I always appreciate it.
Hey, man, no problem, Mac. See you later.
All right. Take care, Mac.
All right, guys. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.